Les hommes se réjouissent lorsque le soleil se lève et lorsque le soleil se couche. Ça devrait être pour eux un avertissement que tout a son horreur et son couchant. Ils se réjouissent du printemps quand tout nous semble jeune et nouveau. Hélas, à mesure que l'année entraîne les saisons, notre vie nous échappe. Scene 7, July 1895. Kivikoski, Thunder Bay. Professor Tahati Avine in conversation with William Ogilvie. The couplet begins in Lokaku and it ends in Helmiku. So we have a time window from 1895 to 1897 when the couplet events occur. But we also have an intervention window and that's in Yoluku. It's either this one in December 1895 or it's the next one in 1896. Those are the only two opportunities we have. It's Yoluku because it is the only non-null prime number forming month. The November digits when added do not form a prime number and all the other months have a zero in them. A validation test came from Albus who took the sinistral digit from the sinistral month Vasemalle and the dextral digit from the dextral month Oikialle to form the intervention code that brings us to Yoluku, the last month of the year. I was able to crack most of Copernicus's code last Christmas and was able to also predict that the chief healer will be born this year in 1895 and his birth was confirmed on May 11th, which had to be a prime number month outside of this couplet event that starts in October and ends in Feb. So when you look at the other 7 months, it's easy to narrow it down to Malisku, Toukuku or Heinaku. Now, Malisku, or March, was rejected because it does not fit the couplet theme. July was kind of tricky because the Okami eggs hatch from late May to just before the flooding season in July. But then from the weather and hatchling data, I was able to narrow down the geolocation and improve my confidence score for Toukuku, or May, which we've already confirmed. So the chief healer was born on May 11th, 1895. I do need your help with something though. Albus is busy with his trans-species transfiguration research. It's either you or along. Would be great if all three of us could go, but the approval form allows only two travelers. Long would be great to help me select the Okami eggs that Kettleburn needs, and your expertise in surveying and should I say Muggle diplomacy are much sought after. It certainly helps folks like me. My research took me to the Western Ghats, but you know how clumsy I am around Muggle settlements. I need to be there during our intervention window this year, so please let me know if you can join me. End of scene 7.
Welcome to Sartastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. This podcast is dedicated to Fraser Mendonca, who left Denver and Leti in September 2023 before their October road trip to Northern BC and the Yukon.
Oh, it's an old book, an 1898 report by Ogilvie. I've taken the French edition. I also have the English edition, but I want to take the French edition to practice reading in French. It's been a while. Anyway, so the book is titled Guide officiel du Klondike. Le Grand Champ d'Or du Canada, le District du Yukon. Roots to Kenya. Whatever I can't pronounce, and I know I'm for sure going to mess it up big time, I'll probably go with English. Voyons d'abord le projet de la Roots to Kenya. The Victoria à Port Simpson, à l'extrême nord de la Colombie anglaise. Le voyage est facile et se fait continuellement sur les eaux de marée de l'intérieur. Si nous voulons faire le voyage entier sur un navire anglais, nous pouvons prendre un vapeur de rivière à Port Simpson. Arrivé à ce point, il nous faudra attendre une occasion favorable pour traverser le Dixon Entrance et remonter ensuite à 170 milles plus haut, jusqu'à l'embouchure de la Stikine River. En remontant cette dernière à 150 milles plus loin, nous arrivons à un point à partir duquel on espère bientôt construire une bonne route et peut-être un chemin de fer qui nous conduira jusqu'au lac Teslin. Depuis la rivière jusqu'au lac il y a environ 150 milles. La traversée du lac est de 65 milles. En descendant la rivière du même nom, la Hootalinqua, des Mineurs, il y a 135 milles par eau pour arriver à la Lewis River. Au relevé de ce lac et de cette rivière a été fait tout récemment par M. Arthur St. Cyr pour le gouvernement canadien et les distances données plus haut sont telles qu'il les a déterminées. Il nous dit que ce lac et cette rivière sont faciles à naviguer avec des vapeurs de rivière ordinaires. Ils ont à effectuer la descente au mois d'octobre lorsque les eaux étaient à 10 ou 12 pieds au-dessous du niveau des crues ordinaires, d'où l'on peut conclure que la navigation est toujours possible sur toute la longueur du parcours. Il a toujours pour trouver un passage en essayant de passer à l'aise que là où il se trouvait arrêté. De l'embouchure de la Hootalinqua à Dawson, il y a 330 milles, où l'on ne rencontrait qu'un seul obstacle, les Five Finger Rapids. Ceux-ci ne sont pas dangereux et ne consistent qu'une barrière de rochers qui refoule l'eau de telle sorte qu'au amont de la barre, elle se trouve être d'un ou deux pieds plus haut qu'elles ne le sont en aval. Presque tout le monde y passe. Il faut dire qu'il y en a beaucoup qui embarquent de l'eau, mais je crois que cet inconvénient provient de ce qu'on force la marche du bateau et traverse le remous ou lieu de le laisser aller à la dérive. En 1895, j'ai franchi ces rapides sur le côté gauche de la rivière et j'ai trouvé partout l'eau tranquille et unie. Le chenal était un peu sinueux, mais pas cessé pour empêcher qu'on ne s'y maintienne avec aise. Le passage dont on se sert le plus souvent se trouve à droite, mais de ce côté-là, il y a un plongeon considérable à faire. Est un peu plus bas, un remous qui est assez dangereux. Lorsque j'y suis passé en 1895, les eaux étaient plus hautes de 5 pieds qu'elles ne le sont d'habitude à cette époque, et je crois que cette circonstance a peut-être facilité les choses. De là jusqu'à Dawson, il n'y a plus aucun obstacle à moins qu'on ne veuille franchir les Rink Rapids à 6 milles plus bas. C'est lorsqu'il y a une barrière de rochers qui s'étend au travers de la moitié du fleuve et qui agite passablement la surface du côté gauche. Sur le droit, cependant, le courant est très uni et on y trouvera toujours 6 pieds d'eau au moins. Le trajet par terre jusqu'au lac Teslin se fait au travers d'un pays ondulé qui ne présenterait aucun obstacle sérieux à la construction de chemins de fer. Je dirais même qu'il serait possible d'y construire une voie terrée presque aussi rapidement qu'une route. On s'attend à y créer une voie de communication facile l'été prochain. En 1896, le vapeur calédonien de la Hudson Bay Company a fait deux voyages de Port Simpson à la Stikina et de la jusqu'à Telegraph Creek. En 1897, il a encore fait le même voyage deux fois. La durée du trajet de Simpson à Wrangell et l'embouchure de la Stikina est de 6 heures environ. Avec un chargement complet, ce vapeur tirait 4 pieds d'eau et ne s'est jamais trouvé embarrassé par le manque d'eau que sur le banc de marée à l'embouchure. À certains endroits où le cours du fleuve fait un détour rapide, il a fallu amarrer des câbles sur les bords, mais cela a été plutôt nécessaire pour maintenir le bateau dans le chenal que pour l'aider à remonter le courant. La durée ordinaire du trajet est de 37 heures environ, sans compter le temps qu'on mette à prendre le chargement du bois du chauffage. La descente se fait en 14 heures en y comprenant tous les temps d'arrêt et de chargement du bois. Ce vapeur a 150 pieds de longueur, 24 pieds 4 poussées de largeur, 2 machines, 2 cylindres et 6 pouces de diamètre et un coup de piston de 6 pieds. La limite de la pression de vapeur est de 130 livres et la moyenne, la plus haute, est de 90 livres. La roue fait 24 révolutions à la minute dans les eaux montées et 35 aux endroits où le courant est très rapide. En remontant la stikine, cette moyenne est de 4000 à l'heure environ et de 12,5 000 en redescendant.
Oh my god, just reading this much was so difficult. This is the first time. It's been a while, man. And as you can see, I've been reading it terribly, but I still wanted to put it out there so I could start practicing. And then we go back to our other text, because anyways, we are done with the stikine route. We keep talking about the stikine route. Well, let's go back to our text, which is about the Yukon Tanana.
Scene 8. Quiet Lake, Yukon Territory. Professor Scamander.
To this day, I don't know how Professor Dahatiyavain confirmed the location of the Chief Healer's birth. That's a puzzle for you, Aranya. All I know is that Mum helped Professor Dumbledore, Ogilvy, and Professor Dahatiyavain get a license to take two of her hippogriffs to South India. They wanted to collect the tears of the Chief Healer. I'm told that the Scamanders and Kettleburns were the only licensed hippogriff breeders at the time, so one of them had to be the guarantor. And I learned, many years later, that Mum was given a portkey which contains a few drops of the Chief Healer's tears. It's the one you and I use to go back in time to find our clues and to heal the wounds we can. Speaking of clues, how far have you progressed with your research on the Yukon Tanana terrain? Did you find anything?
It's not looking good, Professor Scamander. I backed off from the Liard route, per your suggestion, and then went back to digging around the Sydney stream, which is south of Quiet Lake. Arthur St. Cyr refers to that stream as Muddy River, but zilch. So I'm gonna be diving into Ogilvy's documents on the Yukon. Perhaps there's something there. But before I forget, did you figure out that misdirection? And if Timothy is involved in the heist, have you traced his steps?
Yes, I did. He's back home, and we can talk all about it when you get back to Frasden. When do you plan to return?
I don't know yet, but not before I find an eclogite site. At least that's the one I'm looking for right now, based on the paper. I need to translate one of Ogilvy's reports, which is in French. Oh man, I wish we had a spill to become native speakers instantly. Anyway, I've got to get going, Professor Scamander. Thanks for checking on me.
Oh, Canada, there the nose are you. Ton histoire est une épopée des plus brillants exploits. Et ta valeur de foi trompée protégera nos foyers et nos
Il y a très peu d'endroits au monde qui aient attiré l'attention du public autant que cette fraction du district du Yukon, dans le dominion du Canada, qui est connu sous le nom du Klondike. Cette curiosité
éveillée il y a quelques mois seulement, s'est récemment accrue avec une telle intensité que l'on voit aujourd'hui des vingtaines de milliards de personnes tourner les regards de ce côté dans l'espoir d'y trouver un jour la fortune et le bonheur. À la seule fin de fournir le meilleur renseignement possible à tous ceux qui les veulent, l'honorable le ministère de l'Intérieur ordonnait la publication immédiate d'un manuel devant contenir tous les renseignements les plus complètes à cet égard. La besogne m'a été enseignée tout naturellement parce que de tous les employés du gouvernement canadien, je me trouvais être celui qui connaisse le mieux cette région. Je commençais donc ce travail vers le milieu du mois de décembre dernier, quelques jours après mon retour. On comprendra sans doute pourquoi ce livre n'est peut-être pas aussi bien fini que j'aurais désiré le voir quand j'aurais dit que, pour le compléter, il m'a fallu préparer des cartes spéciales, choisir des photographies sans nombre et les mettre en bon état pour la reproduction, écrire bon nombre de chapitres nouveaux et relire de nombreux rapports anciens, faire par moi-même et par d'autres, choisir, mettre en ordre et intercoller comme il faut, mais non dans le nouveau texte. Cette tâche était d'autant plus difficile que, lorsque j'étais en voyage, la plupart du travail m'était imposé. Mes notes, prises en plein air, comme elles l'avaient été, étaient difficilement intelligibles à d'autres qu'à moi, car je les avais souvent écrites quand j'avais les mains engourdies et les sons presque paralysés par le froid terrible des vents d'hiver sur le sommet glacé des montagnes. Tout défectueux qu'il soit, cet ouvrage suffira, je l'espère, pour combler les lacunes qu'il est destiné à remplir. Il en restera bien peut-être quelques-unes, mais elles seront faciles à combler pour ceux qui voudront se donner la peine de réfléchir un peu. Les extraits tirés de rapports anciens ont été revus et amplifiés d'après les renseignements les plus récents. Si l'on consultait ces anciens reports, il ne faudra donc pas s'étonner de trouver certaines différences. Cette partie de l'ouvrage qui est de création récente est aussi complète que possible. Il m'aurait fallu infiniment plus de temps que je n'en avais devant moi pour donner des détails suffisamment nombreux pour répondre à toutes les questions qui peuvent se présenter. Je sais par expérience que ceux qui croient penser à tout n'éprouveront aucune difficulté à poser les questions les plus diverses, qu'elles se rapportent ou non au sujet que nous avons à traiter, et si je le voulais, je pourrais certainement remplir ce volume d'exemples pareils qui sont uniques dans leur genre. Je préfère les laisser de côté cependant et m'adresser tout simplement aux sympathies de ceux qui ont l'esprit plus pratiqué et qui savent compter un peu aussi sur leurs propres ressources. Les cartes ont été préparées à la hâte, mais elles donnent néanmoins tous les renseignements connus et recueillis, soit au cœur de mes observations personnelles, soit par oui dire. Je ferai observer que sur la carte qui indique les routes diverses, celles qui suivent une rivière ou un cours d'eau quelconque, sont indiquées avec exactitude, tandis que les routes de terre ne sont indiquées qu'approximativement et ne représentent que le projet seulement. Ceci tient à ce qu'on n'a encore fait aucune relevée de ces routes, ou bien que si ces relèves existent, je ne les ai pas eues sous la main. Au revoir. Ottawa, le 27 janvier 1898. En 1898, William Ogilvy. geology of Quiet Lake and Finlayson Lake map areas, South Central Yukon, an early interpretation of bedrock stratigraphy and structure by DJ Templeman Cluett, 2012. Quiet Lake and Finlayson Lake map areas include the heart of the Pelly Mountains. They comprise late Proterozoic to early Mesozoic platform and outer shelf strata of ancient North America that were shortened during Mesozoic folding and thrust faulting. These strata are structurally overlain by thrust slices of metamorphosed Paleozoic sedimentary, volcanic, and gneissic rocks that originated far from this continent. Both the in-place and overthrust rocks were intruded by plutons of late Mesozoic age. The map areas are bisected diagonally by the Tintina Trench, which is underlain by a dextral strike slip fault of 450-450 km of post-Cretaceous displacement. This open file report presents a general description of the regional stratigraphy of the two map areas and an interpretation of structure, metamorphism, and igneous history as they were understood in the early 1980s. It builds upon fieldwork dating back to Operation Pelly, a large and wide-ranging reconnaissance survey in central Yukon begun by the Geological Survey of Canada in 1958. 1958. The field observations upon which the stratigraphic units are based were principally made between 1973 and 1976. The report describes principal structures and develops a comprehensive structural interpretation with deductions of the relative timing of the faults. The mineral deposits are placed in a regional tectonic framework. It is a classic report that extends from field observations to proposed correlations of stratigraphy, structural models, and imaginative geological hypotheses, which can be tested by further geological work. These include the concept of discrete packages of platform stratigraphy overlapped on low-angle thrust faults and the recognition of internally deformed sheets of alloctinous, sedimentary, volcanic, and plutonic rock overlying the platform strata. The latter idea resulted in a widely read and acclaimed paper by Templeman Cluett, 1979. At the time of writing, the techniques for isotopic dating limited the interpretation of metamorphic rock units, and for them this report is no longer relevant. Nevertheless, some aspects of the regional tectonic model expounded here have served for 25 years. Southwest of Tintina, the regional mapping and descriptions of stratigraphic units, primarily the Pelly-Cassiar platform and slope facies, herein remain current. Most of Quiet Lake map area has not seen systematic bedrock mapping during the last 30 years. The Pelly Mountains in central Yukon expose a cross-section through part of the collision orogene, that is the Canadian Cordillera. Elements of this cross-section are the pre-tectonic autochthonous succession, clipping of sheared and metamorphosed alloctinous rocks, thrusts that repeat the autochthonous succession, late tectonic regional metamorphic rocks and associated granite batholiths, and the Tintina Fault, a late tectonic dextral strike slip fault. Late Proterozoic through Triassic shelf strata, 6 to 8 kilometers thick, comprise the autochthonous sequence. They are divided into four main divisions bounded by unconformities or a depositional hiatus. Oldest are Eocambrian and Lower Cambrian shale and siltstone, capped by an argillaceous limestone, which together form the Ketzer group. There is a mention in the episode on the Quiet Lake batholith where we talk about Reed doing his masters around the Ketzer group. Unconformably above it are Upper Cambrian and Ordovician slate, phyllite, and alkaline basalt of the Kachika group, and Silurian and Devonian siltstone, dolostone, and quartz sandstone of the Askin group. Profound and rapid facies variation characterizes this second division. Also part of this division is the shale-dominated Harvey group, which is time equivalent to the Kachika and Askin groups. unconformably above our Upper Devonian and Mississippian black slate and the marine felsic volcanic rocks, the Seagull Group. The fourth division is thin and restricted in distribution. It includes a Permian and an Upper Triassic siltstone separated by a disconformity. The autochthonous succession extends to and is like that in the Cassiar Mountains. It has equivalent units in the northern Rocky Mountains. Broadly, it is equivalent to the outer shelf of the North American Myogeoclinal Wedge. Three assemblages of ductile deformed rocks are thrust over the in-place succession from the southwest. Although each assemblage is dismembered so that its internal stratigraphy is unknown, the three are not mixed and exhibit a consistent structural order. Lowest is a myelinite schist that represents Triassic, or perhaps an older, immature clastic rock and intermediate volcanics. Next is an assemblage of late Paleozoic amphibolite and serpentinite with Flaser limestone. Highest are granodiorite, gneiss, and schist, the sheared and metamorphosed remnant of Paleozoic intrusive rocks. Potassium-argon ages, KAR ages, show that all three assemblages were sheared and metamorphosed during the late Triassic and early Jurassic. Four northeast-directed thrusts repeat the in-place beds beneath and northeast of the transported strata. Cumulative shortening is on the order of 100 kilometers. Each thrust carries a slice 2 or 3 kilometers thick and is itself deformed by newer thrusts, folds, and tear faults. The thrusts interplayed as plays of one basal detachment formed in sequence from southwest to northeast during late Jurassic and early Cretaceous. On the southwest, the structurally imbricated in-place strata and the transported rocks above them were regionally metamorphosed about the late early Cretaceous to form the Big Salmon and Mink complexes. At the same time, partial melting produced granites like the Quiet Lake, Narzetlin, and Big Salmon batholiths. The metamorphic rocks are exposed in large structural culminations centered roughly on the batholiths. These fold early thrusts, giving a structural relief near 8 kilometers. Some granites might be cut by thrusts below, and the metamorphic culmination may be severed by the basal detachment. Tintina Fault is the locus of 450 kilometers of dextral slip as shown by offset of the autochthonous succession. Movement followed intrusion of most or all of the late tectonic granites. Movement may have been seized by early Eocene when fluvial conglomerate was laid down along the fault. Because its slip coincides with shortening in the Selwyn and Mackenzie Mountains, the Tintina is considered to be a listric branch of the same detachment surface on which shortening was accomplished. It is viewed as a giant tear fault in the detached slab. A model in which the Peri Mountains are the product of Middle Jurassic oblique collision of a volcanic arc with the then western margin of ancient North America fits these data. Sheared metamorphic rocks, which are interpreted as the arc's subduction complex, were abducted in the late Jurassic. Cretaceous imbrications and textural translation of the autochthonous rocks are responses to abduction, while metamorphism and plutonism reflect heating of the overridden and imbricated in-place slab. Evidence of arc continent collision. Allochthonous Mesozoic and or Upper Paleozoic siliceous myelinite, sheared ophiolite, and cataclastic granitic rocks are preserved in Clipin above autochthonous structurally imbricated Paleozoic and Lower Mesozoic North American shelf strata in central Yukon. The siliceous myelinite may be a trench melange, the ophiolite oceanic forearc floor, and the granitic rocks, the roots of a northeast-facing early Mesozoic arc later accreted to North America.
If so, they imply that the arc system was partly thrust over the early Mesozoic North American margin. Northeast polarity of the arc suggests that it formed above southwestern subducting oceanic lithosphere, and that the arc continent suture marks a major closed ocean. Northeast abduction provides one continuous model for accreting the early Mesozoic arc to North America, for forming the foreland fold and thrust belt, and for forming late tectonic quartz monzonite plutons. It relates variations in the width of the fold belt to the degree of arc abduction. The duration and rates of the events are comparable to those in other mountain belts and subduction complexes. St. Cyr Clippen, just south of Nazatlan Lake, siliceous blastomyelinite lies above Siluro-Devonian orthoquartzite. The cataclastic rocks are part of the Nazatlan Alocton and form a large erosional remnant, the St. Cyr Clippen. St. Cyr Clippen is preserved in a broad northwest trending structural depression 150 meters long between the Quiet Lake and Nazatlan batholiths. Its cataclastic fabric dips gently into the structural depression from the northeast and southwest. The basal surface of the St. Cyr Clippen beneath the siliceous cataclysite was not seen, but its trace implies that it conforms with the structural depression. As in the McNeil Clippen, the rocks include muscovite and chlorite quartz myelinite and blastomyelinite, probably derived from siliceous sedimentary and volcanic rocks. Their flaser fabric is generally folded and transposed on a penetrative crenulation cleavage that dips southwest. On the northeast, the myelinite lies above Siluro-Devonian orthoquartzite and siltstone that is not cataclastic or metamorphosed. On the southwest, it rests on roughly coeval graphitic quartz siltstone, the Nisina facies, with lenses of carbonate. Bedding dips gently under the clippe. In the central part of the St. Cyr Clippen, the siliceous cataclysite is overlapped by a structurally high slice of transported ophiolite, and at the northwest extremity of the clippe, the ophiolite lies directly above the autochthonous strata. The rocks include amphibolite, sheared basalt, serpentinized peridotite, and altered gabbro, part of the Anvil Alocton. Relations between the Nazatlan and Anvil Alochtons are poorly exposed within the St. Cyr Clippen. The siliceous and ophiolitic cataclysites generally occur separately, although slivers of ophiolite 100 meters thick are seen within the siliceous cataclysite near contact with the Anvil Alochton. The contact between the Anvil Alocton and the autochthonous rock below is well exposed on the north side of Mount St. Cyr at the northwest end of the St. Cyr Clippen. There the ophiolite is flintly textured, streaky cataclysite of basaltic composition made up of fine-grained amphiboles, which grades laterally into amphibolite, its blastomyelinitic equivalent. The preserved thickness of the ophiolite cataclysite is at least 1,000 meters, and the degree of cataclysis varies so that parts of the mass are protoclastic and others are ultramyelinite. Rocks near the basal surface are not more cataclastic than those elsewhere in the clippe. Serpentinized peridotite occurs as sheets within the ophiolite. The sheets are structurally bounded and probably represent internal repetitions of the Anvil Alocton. The serpentinite is generally massive and fish scale textures are rare. Devono-Mississippian slate with interbedded chert granule grit is exposed beneath the ophiolite. These rocks are not cataclysmic, although the chert granules are flattened locally. In a contact zone about 50 meters thick, slate and cataclysite are tectonically mixed and discontinuous lenses of the two rocks are interlaid, but otherwise no mixing was seen. Bedding in the autochthonous rocks below the contact conforms roughly with the basal surface of the ophiolite. At the southwest margin of the St. Cyr Clippen, a small undated discordant pluton of porphyritic biotite quartz monzonite invades the siliceous myelinite. On the northeast margin, the ophiolitic cataclysite is cut and thermally metamorphosed by Nazitlin batholith, a homogeneous body of similar quartz monzonite whose biotite was given 84, 89 and 94 million years based on the KAR model ages. That's potassium-argon model ages. Then we have the Dunite Clippin, northwestward along the structural depression occupied by St. Cyr Clippe are the Dunite Clippin, outliers of the Anvil Alocton. These are parts of a spectacular sheet of serpentinized peridotite that cap two adjacent peaks above 800 meters of autochthonous platform to outer shelf strata of late Proterozoic to Silurian or early Devonian age. The serpentinite is a massive brown weathering altered alpine ultramafite. The sole at the base of the ultramafic clippin lies nearly flat at an elevation of 1500 meters and is marked in places by fish scales, serpentinite and talcose rocks that occur in a zone of up to 100 meters thick. Strata immediately below the contact are nearly flat-lying, unsheared orthoquartzite with interbedded dolomite sandstone and graphitic calcareous siltstone. Then he's going towards Faro, which is 70 kilometers northwest of the Ross River, but that's outside our area. That's why I will stop here. This was just a chunk that was picked out from this 1979 paper by Templeman Clouet. So all the work that is done, the field work that was done between 1974 and 77 is mentioned here, around the same area like Quiet Lake Finlayson. And I'm recording it because we read Arthur St. Cyr's description around the Teslin Lake, and there is a peak there. He's named it after himself. I think it's northwest of the Quiet Lake. That's why we've covered this, and those connections have to be made right from the 1976 paper where we described the stratigraphy around the Pelly Mountains, and we spoke about the Quetzal Peak, the Porcupine Thrust there, and then the other papers where we speak about the Quiet Lake, and then we come to this paper now in 1979. So I would have to continue linking these papers to finally come up with a chapter where we talk about these links around the Tintina Fault for now. But we're doing the whole Yukon Tanana terrain, but this is right now focused around the Tintina Fault. And there is a mention of an eclogite as well. That paper will come up, but not so soon. There are two papers there, I think two or three papers about eclogites. So right now we're looking at obviously the Teslin Suture. We had the Teslin Survey Area, the Big Salmon Area, the Nazitlin Area, the Quiet Lake Area. These names will come up because the next Sartastic Beast is around this area, slightly north of this area, but it might even cover this area because I haven't read that paper, but it's slightly north, and we will look at interferometric SAR. The last was again the range migration algorithm, so we were in the Mary Kotka house, but this story is about the applications, so we are going to the Mary Mies house. Even though we talk about a technology, we're not going to talk about algorithms and processes. We will be talking about the application of interferometric SAR at that location, and that's why I wanted to bring up these markers. So these names are cemented, at least for this season. We're going to be around this area quite a lot. We will probably not go to McNeil and Moss Lake because we've had a conversation between Professor Abbott and Scamander where they talk about Susi Pethunin being told not to go that side because Ogilvy has covered quite a lot of that area. Let's pause at that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sartastic Beast and Where to Find Them. The intro and outro music is by Yaakov Goldman, courtesy of Free Music Archive.